listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including teachers resigning from abandoned schools, a climate action plan in Humboldt County, and the effects of a mill closure in Weed. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Reporter Jane Vaughn is off today, so we'll start with the conversation she and Roman recorded yesterday.
Jane, you published a feature this week about some turmoil at the Bandon School District. First, how did you find out about this story and why did you decide to report on it?
So I actually found out about this story from a listener, from a parent, who actually reached out to our colleague Justin in October, and then he passed it on to me since I do our education coverage. So for all you listeners out there, if you do send in a tip, we will often do stories on it, so send us your ideas. So I got this tip from a parent in Bandon. She has kids in the school district, and she was concerned about what was going on there and wanted to let us know. So she was talking about involuntary teacher transfers and alleged misconduct by the superintendent and all this sorts of stuff. And so I spoke with her first, just off the record, taking notes. And then as a reporter, obviously the first step is let's go check this out. You have to verify everything. This is what I've heard from this one person. Is this true? Is this happening? How do we fact check this? What evidence exists to support this or not? And then, so for this story, a lot of it ended up being interviews and records requests. And so I basically started off with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that happens a lot with reporting. You know, we get a lot of emails from people who that might be about a lot of bad stuff that's going on or claim that there's all this stuff happening. And it's important that we check that to make sure it's actually true, because sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. So you had to go in there and figure out what
right.
the facts were there. So tell me a little bit more about how you did the reporting for this story.
So it ended up taking a lot longer than I anticipated. It took more than 2 months because there were so many people to talk to. And then the more people that you speak with, the more questions you have, and there's more things to verify. So I started talking with people. Some of that was on the record. Some people wanted to be off the record. Talked to parents, current and former teachers in Bandon, former employees, people involved with the union. Some people that I reached out to didn't want to be interviewed or wanted to be anonymous. And then I tried really hard to talk with the district. I would have really loved to talk with district administrators. I sent them multiple emails over months, all the school board members, the superintendent, the high school principal, the special education director. The special education director did sort of respond, but for the most part, they never really substantially responded to my questions. They never made anyone available for an interview. They did send out sort of a public statement at one point, but without having an interview with them, I then had to try to find their point of view elsewhere. So then I'm looking at Facebook posts, social media, what are they saying at school board meetings, using that statement they released to try to get their opinion and their side of things in the story too. And then in addition to that, I'm looking at other documents and data and things like that. So school board meeting agendas, the union contract, the negotiation documents are posted online. There's state data about Oregon school districts. I watched a lot of school board meeting videos. A lot of people I talked to sent me emails and complaints they had filed. And then this website that was put up called Do Better BSD had lots of documents there too. And then I'm also reaching out to official entities to do records requests. So Oregon Government Ethics Commission, Oregon Department of Education, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Employment Relations Board. I've reached out to Oregon School Boards Association. And then everything that everyone says, all the information that I'm getting back potentially leads to more questions. So then I have to cross-reference things and confirm with other people, fact-check everything. And so I ended up with dozens of pages of stuff for this story. And that's how it took so long.
Yeah, it really shows. I remember you talking about this story in the newsroom for a long time, working on it and going through all these documents. And it really just shows the kind of length you're going through to kind of make sure you're getting all the information, because that's a really important part in reporting is that you're telling, you know, all sides of the story. But when one side doesn't want to talk to you, then it makes, you know, your job that much more difficult, because you have to figure out a way to tell, you know, what is their side of the story without actually talking to them.
Right.
You know, you mentioned all of this stuff that's going on. What was difficult, the most difficult about reporting the story?
Well, number one, like I've said, it just took a really long time, longer than I had planned necessarily for it to take, but there was just a lot to do. Number two, I think doing stories about individual schools or districts can be difficult, especially in a small town like Bandon, because everyone kind of knows everyone and everybody's sort of in everybody else's business. I grew up in a small town, so I get it, but there's sort of fear of reprisal or potential pushback from your neighbors, and you run into people at the grocery store, so that can make it a little bit awkward. Again, I really wish I'd been able to talk to the district administrators. I totally understand they can't comment on individual specific personnel files, but I would have loved even some broader context or how do these things typically work or something beyond just the general public statement they released. And it was also tricky because the situation is still ongoing and evolving. The hearing with the Employment Relations Board isn't until February. The school board only voted recently to begin an inquiry into some of the complaints it has received, so that was pretty recent. And so at a certain point, it's like, when is the best time to do a story on this? And this is just the information that I had so far. More information will come up and we'll learn new things in the weeks and months to come. So this is sort of just the beginning of where I'm at right now. So we'll have to keep following and see what happens next.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. And, you know, there's really good reporting up there on our website from it right now. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
And that was reporter Jane Vaughn. Roman, you reported yourself on the adoption of a regional climate action plan in Humboldt County. Tell us more about this plan.
Yeah, so this kind of basically brings together the county and then most of the major cities in Humboldt County, and it kind of creates this starting point for the county and the city partners to work together on reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the county. So it sort of ties into the statewide goals that California has set. There have been different laws, a bunch of different laws that I've seen them that have been passed setting different goals for the state. But some important ones were overall greenhouse gas emissions should be 40% less than what they were in 1990 by 2030. And then the state aims to achieve carbon neutrality completely by 2045. So they have some pretty heavy goals to set. So this is going to help Humboldt County achieve those locally and kind of do their part. Right now, Humboldt is not really forecasted to reach that 2030 goal, so this plan is going to help with that a lot. And there's sort of 12 major strategies that they've outlined, and then there's a bunch of actions underneath those strategies covering all sorts of things from transportation, construction, reducing waste, and all sorts of other stuff.
I think we've heard about these globally. Are climate action plans something that's common for cities and counties to enact?
Kinda. It depends. I mean, we do have data for California specifically for the numbers of cities and counties that have developed one. It's not a mandatory thing, but it is encouraged by the state to do. So right now, just over half of counties have adopted one or are working on a plan, and then that's about the same for the number of cities in California. You know, most of the counties that haven't done one are the kind of rural counties with smaller populations, which is sort of to be expected. But, you know, in Oregon, it's kind of harder to tell how many places have adopted one because there's not really a centralized database. Oregon has this statewide climate action plan and are doing a lot of statewide stuff, but it's not necessarily like county to county, city to city. But like Jackson County, Medford, Ashland, and Grants Pass have all adopted their own sort of versions of climate action plans.
And so what kind of changes can Humboldt County residents expect because of this?
Yeah, I mean, don't expect anything like immediately to change. you know, there's not like a bunch
of— Don't stop driving your car tomorrow.
Yeah, there's not like a bunch of regulations that are imposed by this regional climate action plan, but this is sort of a roadmap for staff to look at and then focus on in the coming years. The biggest area they're going to be looking at is transportation because that's by far the biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Humboldt County. They have a pretty poor public transportation infrastructure, so a lot of people are relying on cars, and they have to ship a lot of things into Humboldt County because it's a pretty remote area separated from a lot of California. It's harder to get those supplies in. So, you know, they're talking about things like expanding access to electric vehicle charging, increasing access to public transportation, and also like creating decarbonization plans for buildings and stuff. Some of this is like funding things like, oh, staff should be applying for the X amount of grants every year, something related to electric vehicle charging or something. Or it could just be like, let's develop a plan for decarbonization for this. So there's different kind of things that staff should be looking at. You know, a lot of it is building on what's already working in the county and what is already working really well. But there is some new stuff, and it kind of gives a place for staff to look at, to hone in on, and prioritize as they're working on this.
And you also reported on some debate over the carbon emission thresholds. What are these thresholds? What do they do?
Yeah, they're a bit complicated, and I hope I've, you know, got all my information correct, because it's kind of complicated and I'm trying to distill it down. But they were separate to the regional plan but kind of related. There are these greenhouse gas emission thresholds that developers will use when building new homes or businesses in the county. So basically it kind of makes it easier to tell if the development meets the state climate standards. You know, if the planning department and the developer determine that this development is under the thresholds, then it's basically considered not significant in terms of its contribution to climate change. But if it's over that threshold, then the developer will have to make changes to decrease the carbon footprint, like, you know, increasing access to public transportation in that area or installing more energy efficient lighting or weatherization or things like that. You know, the initial proposed thresholds were much higher than other cities and counties have set. So the staff and the planning commission recommended bringing them significantly down, and that's partly also to make it easier to meet those 2030 and 2045 climate goals. But the concern is if you bring them down too low, then that's going to scare away developers and they're not going to want to build. So there was a lot of debate around what level to set.
And what did supervisors ultimately decide?
Yeah, they eventually, after a lot of talking, they finally agreed on setting the thresholds at 65% of what was originally recommended, so a little bit lower, sort of the middle ground there. You know, of course, those are going to change in the future. This plan is going to be updated in 2030 as the county then sort of looks to 2045 towards complete carbon neutrality. So we'll see more changes, you know, in just 5 years.
Okay. Well, thanks, Roman. Justin, you had a feature about a mill closing kind of in our own backyard. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was the Roseburg Forest Products Mill in Weed. That's in Siskiyou County. And earlier this month, Roseburg announced it would be stopping operations at the mill and laying off all of its 140 or so workers, which maybe that doesn't sound a lot, although it kind of sounded a lot for me. But especially for Weed and the county, this is a really big deal. So Siskiyou County is very rural. Not a lot of people live there. And there's not a lot of well-paying jobs, especially for those without a college education. And the mill really was that. So you'd get over $20 an hour. It was a union job. You'd get benefits through that. And it was really kind of this holdover, as I see it, from a different time when those kind of blue-collar jobs that paid well were more plentiful, when the timber industry was kind of roaring and providing a living for a lot of people.
Well, you spoke to some former workers. What did they have to say?
They were pretty down, understandably. So I spoke to one 22-year-old guy. He's engaged. His fiancée's pregnant. He doesn't have a college degree, and this mill job was really a way for him to raise a family in the area. He told me he really looked up to people who had spent years working at this mill and kind of risen from the bottom into a really well-paying career. No one's getting rich, but you can support a family through this work, or you used to be able to. And, you know, he and his fiance were discussing buying a home and making all of these plans, and that's kind of fallen away after the mill's closed. And you can imagine these knock-on effects of the mill closing. It's not only impacting the workers, but, you know, businesses will suffer, schools will suffer, especially if people leave the county. That can lead to more layoffs, and that's a kind of spiral that happens in these former timber areas, and it's something people really want to avoid in Weed.
Yeah, and, you know, just reporting this, you found kind of an interesting history there in Weed, right?
Yeah, Weed's a cool place. So my fiance has family nearby, so I've been there a few times, and I really like the place. It's very charming. Weed takes its name from Abner Weed. He was a timber entrepreneur who bought a mill there in 1897. And for much of its history, Weed was this kind of company town, with the mill as the main employer. At its peak, 1,700 workers were employed at the mill. But as the timber industry declined, Weed, you know, took a hit like a lot of towns in the county. The town's population fell by a third since 1960. And since then, you know, it's still going, but businesses have sort of struggled there.
And how has the city reacted to the mill closing?
That was a big part of the story. So the community has really come together very quickly to support these former workers and families. There's a GoFundMe campaign. Cafes are offering meals. Social media is sort of flooded with people wanting to help. And this really, you know, comes about, well, this kind of reaction comes about because they've had a lot of disasters in the past. They've had multiple fires which have destroyed hundreds of buildings just in the last 5 years alone. And the community has kind of been trained to come together, it seems, seems like, and really support each other. So less than a week after the mill closed, the college set up a job fair where college staff were helping with resume building and offering enrollment opportunities. Employers were there. So I visited that college fair, and it was really nice to see the community come together so quickly to help these former workers.
And very quickly, what's next for Weed?
We don't know. Very early days, Roseburg might sell the mill to another company, but the CEO said that they are evaluating options for the site to continue to support jobs in the local economy, and the city wants to figure something out, too, for that facility.
Okay, thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or your favorite podcast platform.